I've seen a lot of bad storms, but this is absolutely the worst.
Which storm you talking about, Bubba? Take your pick.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, and in Cottage Grove on KSO. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WTPA, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR, in New Orleans on WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, Seattle, Washington's KODX, Red Bluff and Redding, California's KFOI, Round Mountain, California's KKRN, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day for your listening convenience on the internets. On the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I am Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today, because today, Desi Doyne, guess what it is?
What's
Can
today?
You guess? Can
no,
you guess?
Tell
today,
me.
It is official. Voting in the 2018 midterm general elections has now officially begun. The first votes have been cast. While much of the political world, of course, is consumed with the battle over the Supreme Court nomination, the trade wars of Donald Trump, his Twitter feed, we're going to try to get to as much of that as we can today. But in Minnesota, hello, AM 950. In Minnesota, the first votes of the 2018 midterm elections are now being cast. Election Day 2018, of course, is technically and officially November 6, but Minnesota law allows in-person voting to begin on Friday. That's a full 46 days early before the November 6 election, making it the first battleground state to begin casting actual votes in the fight for control of Congress, and with it, the first real breaks that voters may finally be able to place onto our runaway national emergency, which we'll try to cover today as much as we can. Voters elsewhere will also soon begin voting as well. South Dakota also opened early voting on Friday, not to give them short shrift. Four more states follow in the next 6 days, including key states like New Jersey and Missouri. Hello, Missouri. California, Montana, Arizona are among seven others that will allow early voting in the subsequent 2 weeks. So this thing is underway. But Minnesota in particular is important because there are four U.S. House seats considered to be competitive seats, two of which may be the Republicans' best chance to flip an open Democratic seat from blue to red.
Oh, it's on.
Oh, it's on. And I know a lot of Democrats love early voting. I am not so much of a fan. The best way to maximize the chance of your vote being counted as cast is to cast it on a hand-marked paper ballot at the polling place on Election Day. But of course, if you can't wait, or if you can't vote, I should say, on Tuesday, November 6th, due to work or concerns about long lines or school, voting early is, of course, an option, presuming you do so on a hand-marked paper ballot. You can also get an absentee ballot in many states and then bring that to the polling place for drop-off on Election Day if you're worried about the lines or maybe not being on the rolls. But again, voting by hand-marked paper ballots on Election Day is still the best way to maximize the chances of your vote being counted and counted accurately and tabulated accurately. I will caution that you should check your registration with your state and or county multiple times between now and November 6th, if you're going to wait until November 6th. And it wouldn't hurt to print out proof of your registration with a date on it and bring that proof to the polls to help avoid any surprises that you may encounter on Election Day.
Oh, yeah. And I just want to say on Twitter, I have been seeing a lot of people over the last few weeks saying, oh, my gosh, I checked my registration last month. I checked it again today and I'm off the rolls. So, yes, checking multiple times apparently is necessary.
We will discuss many more of those complications, no doubt, as we get closer to Election Day. But the voting has now officially begun. The first votes have been cast in the 2018 midterm elections. Unfortunately, down in Georgia, the entire state will once again be voting on 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems, at least at the polling place, thanks to a ruling by a federal judge this past week. We will speak to one of the plaintiffs in that case in a little bit here today to understand the ruling, which in many ways, if not the key way, is actually good news, I think, for election integrity advocates overall. Georgia is a great example of where voting absentee is a good idea because they have paper ballots, because you can, that's the only way you'll be able to vote on hand-marked paper ballots. But we will speak with one of those plaintiffs in that case, Marilyn Marks, about all of that shortly. She may or may not feel differently about that. We'll get her thoughts. In the meantime, as we warned was imminent on our previous broadcast, Duke Energy now says a dam has been breached at a plant in North Carolina. Coal ash may be flowing into the Cape Fear River, but that is hardly the only problem still ongoing right now in the Carolinas. No matter whether broadcast media have largely moved on or not, a new round of evacuations was ordered on Friday in South Carolina as the trillions of gallons of water dumped over the past week by Hurricane Florence meanders to the sea, raising the river levels and threatening still more destruction. With the crisis now slowly moving to South Carolina, emergency officials on Friday ordered about 500 people to flee homes along the Lynch's River. The National Weather Service said the river was expected to reach record levels over the weekend. Officials downstream sounded dire alarms on Friday, pointing out the property destruction and environmental disasters left in Florence's wake. Georgetown County Administrator Sel Hemingway warned the area may see a flood like it has never seen before. And again, we're 1 week after landfall was made by Hurricane Florence. In North Carolina, where about 100 people were evacuated by boat and air after the Cape Fear River breached a levee and flooded the town of Kelly on Thursday night, this storm is continuing to wreak havoc. And it's a similar story to places that were flooded back in 2016 in Hurricane Matthew. Some of those towns are once again being inundated. 2 years ago, AP talks about a story of the Presbyterian Church in Spring Lake that had to rebuild after Hurricane Matthew. This year, water from the Little River broke the windows at that same church, left the pews a jumbled mess. Church member Dennis DeLong said, "My gut is turning up. I'm so sad just thinking about all the work that we put in. We put a lot of heart and soul into putting it back up." Well, yeah, but because the state's Republican legislature actually passed a law barring the use of a report on the threat of sea level rise and other climate change threats in North Carolina, people just keep rebuilding. They keep building and rebuilding in the same spots. And I guess the construction industry is delighted about that, but nobody else should be, including the taxpayers who are often on the hook here for what state legislators have been trying to hide to hide from the voters, from the public, that they've been lying about for all of these years. If you didn't catch our previous broadcast with disaster expert and historian Scott Knowles, I recommend you take some time to download it for free at bradblog.com on some of this. In any event, South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster estimated the damage from the flood in his state to be over $1 billion. I believe he's lowballing that estimate, frankly. He says the flooding will be the worst disaster in the state's modern history. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper said he knows the damage in his state is going to add up to billions, perhaps tens of billions, but said with the effects of the storm still ongoing a week later, there is no way to make a more accurate estimate. As far as some of the new ongoing news out of this, as we, yes, had warned on our previous broadcast, while much of the world is no longer paying attention to the Carolinas, Duke Energy had issued a level one alert on Thursday that a toxic coal ash holding pond at one of their retired coal-fired power plants in North Carolina was on the brink of an imminent collapse due to high floodwaters. Well, guess what has now happened? Duke Energy said on Friday that a dam containing a large lake at a power plant in Wilmington has now been breached by floodwaters from Florence, and it is possible, they say, at this hour, that coal ash from an adjacent dump is now flowing into the Cape Fear River. A Duke spokesperson said that floodwaters continue to overtop an earthen dike at the north side of Sutton Lake, which is a reservoir for the Sutton Power Station. That water has caused several breaches in the dam on part of the lake, which is now flowing back into the river. The floodwaters also overtopped a steel retaining wall containing one of three coal ash dumps lining the lake shore. The spokesperson for Duke Energy described the incident as, quote, a developing situation, and said the company can't rule out that coal ash might be escaping and flowing into the river, which, to my mind, if it's coming from Duke Energy, is as good as them saying, yes, it is escaping and flowing into the river. You can bank on that. They have paid millions of dollars in violations of the Clean Water Act for exactly this type of toxic coal ash spill. Gray material that the company called lightweight coal combustion byproducts could be seen on Friday, floating on top of that lake. The ash that is left over when coal is burning to generate electricity, coal ash, it contains an array of toxic components like mercury and lead and arsenic and other toxic heavy metals, or, as Donald Trump calls it,
clean coal. Beautiful clean coal.
Yeah. The inundated basin at the plant contains 400,000 cubic yards of that beautiful clean coal ash, that beautiful toxic coal ash. Floodwaters at the site were continuing to rise on Friday, where the area had received almost 3 feet of water, with the Cape Fear River still expected to crest over the weekend. Security personnel for Duke was blocking access to the lake, even to the media. Duke denied a request for an Associated Press reporter at the scene on Friday to pass the barricade, claiming that the situation at the lake, quote, continues to change and is not safe. Aerial photos, however, are showing a wide breach in the earthen dam and the affected ash dump, largely now underwater. The current breach at the Wilmington site is separate from another rupture at a nearby coal ash landfill reported at the site last week. In 2014, of course, as we noted yesterday, a drainage pipe collapsed under one of these pits and triggered a massive spill that coated 70 miles of the Dan River in gray sludge. The utility agreed to plead guilty to 9 clean water violations and pay $102 million in fines and restitution for illegally discharging pollution from ash dumps at 5 different North Carolina power plants. So it plans to close all of its ash dumps by 2029 in, you know, more than 10 years. But, you know,
clean coal, beautiful clean coal.
At the separate Duke plant near Goldsboro, three old coal ash dumps capped with soil were underwater on Thursday near the Neuse River, which is also flooded. And the Waterkeeper Alliance and environmental group visited some of those dumps, took photographs, and collected samples of gray sludge and water they say is washing into the floodwater. So this could be going on for quite a while. The damage will be revealing itself, I guess, over the next several days, weeks, maybe even months. Hurricane season, of course, is anything but over. On Friday, the National Hurricane Center said it was monitoring 4 different areas in the Atlantic for new tropical weather threats. One is just off the coast of the Carolinas with a chance of drifting toward the coast. Florence is now blamed for at least 42 deaths in the Carolinas and Virginia's and in Virginia. Other potential problems, environmental problems, remain, including human waste, hog waste, other animal waste mixing in with floodwaters in the Carolinas. More than 1,000 roads from major highways to neighborhood lanes are still closed in the Carolinas, officials said. Some of them have been washed out entirely. So, yeah, I know folks have moved on, but many folks in the Carolinas have certainly not, and they won't for quite some time. Meanwhile, speaking of pig poop, there was a headline from CNN on Thursday regarding the way that Trump was dealing with the fight over the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court and the allegations of sexual assault made against him by Palo Alto University professor Christine Blasey Ford. CNN's headline was, the president is bragging about positive coverage for his tactful approach to Kavanaugh's accuser. It's motivated him to keep it up. Well, it didn't motivate him to keep it up for much, for very long. He held on for several days, not attacking his accuser in any way, so to speak. But by Friday, apparently, he could stand it no more. Hey, he almost made it a week. In a series of tweets, Trump suggested that Kavanaugh was, quote, under assault from the, quote, radical left-wing politicians. Minutes later, he claimed that Blasey Ford would have filed charges as a teenager if the alleged assault was, quote, as bad as she says. So he claimed, quote, radical left-wing politicians don't want to know the answers. This from the guy who refuses to ask the FBI to investigate and find out the answers. He added, quote, facts don't matter to Democrats. He then belittled the accusations from Dr. Ford, saying, quote, I have no doubt that if the attack on Dr. Ford was as bad as she says, charges would have been filed immediately with local law enforcement authorities by either her or her loving parents, adding, why didn't someone call the FBI 36 years ago? Well, yeah, they don't usually call local officials or the FBI in these sorts of cases, and especially when you're talking about a 15-year-old kids at a party where they're drinking alcohol, which would be illegal at that age. No, they don't call the police. And of course, they don't call the FBI. In any event, the negotiations continue at this hour between Ford and her attorney and the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. And the entire situation continues to change very quickly. So for now, Dr. Ford may or may not be testifying in the coming weeks before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee and the National Emergency under Donald Trump and his Republican parties continues in its wake. But we are just weeks away from being able to do at least something about it, though that will depend if voters can actually vote and have their votes counted as cast. That will be no easy feat in states like Georgia. A quick break, and we will come back to discuss just some of the reasons why that will yet again be so hard for voters in the Peach State. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is the Bradcast.
Georgia, Georgia.
Oh, yeah. Georgia is on my mind yet again. It's been happening a lot over the past several months, past several years, I should say. And now the state of Georgia said last week that it will continue to distribute inaccurate voter registration forms, which falsely say that registrants are required to enclose documentary proof of residence. And they're going to continue distributing those inaccurate forms until next year at the earliest, according to Atlanta's public radio affiliate WABE. On the incorrect form, first-time registrants are instructed to enclose a copy of one of the following. And then it lists a copy of a current and valid photo ID, your current utility bill, bank statement, government check, paycheck, etc. However, according to the ACLU of Georgia, this is not required for first-time registrants. Sean Young, the legal director of the ACLU of Georgia, told WABE that by putting in this false requirement, you're actually preventing people from registering to vote. Well, that may be a feature, not a bug. Young said that Georgia has been using the inaccurate forms for at least a decade. Over the past 8 years of that decade, the state's election chief has been Republican Secretary of State Brian Kemp, and in the 2 years before that, it was Secretary of State Karen Handel, who reportedly defeated Democrat John Ossoff for a special U.S. House election last year, despite Ossoff leading in the polls and a computer tabulator failure on election night that resulted in Handel leading just after the computer tabulators came back online. Recounts of most of the votes, of course, were not possible thanks to Georgia's 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems that they force voters to use on election day. Though Ossoff reportedly easily defeated Handel in the hand-marked paper ballot absentee votes that came in. More on that in a moment. As to the inaccurate registration forms that are being circulated around Georgia, no, it is not required for voters to send in that residency information in order to register to vote in Georgia for the first time. First-time voters can instead bring proof of residency with them to the polling place rather than include it with their registration. A new form that corrects that has been posted online recently by the Georgia Secretary of State in response to a complaint from the ACLU, and it notes that you can submit proof of residence either with that form or when you vote for the first time. That's what the form should say, because that is correct. That is the law, and that is not misleading like the paper versions that are circulating around the state of Georgia right now for years. According to WABE, however, staff in the office of Secretary of State Brian Kemp said it, quote, wouldn't get a delivery of the revised forms until at least the beginning of next year. That's convenient, and especially convenient for Georgia Secretary of State Brian Kemp. I will explain why after this break, as we are joined by Marilyn Marks of the Coalition for Good Governance on her lawsuit to force the state of Georgia to move from 100% unverifiable voting to hand-marked paper ballots in November. A federal judge has finally rung in on the matter. That story is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
That's a night that the lights went out in Georgia.
Oh, brother. Please, please don't let the lights go out in Georgia on November 6th. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. If that happens, nobody will be able to vote across the state of Georgia. Logan Lamb, a cybersecurity sleuth, thought that he was conducting an innocuous Google search to pull up information on Georgia's centralized voting system for conducting elections way back in 2016, as Ellen Nakashima of the Washington Post reported last week. He was taken aback, however, when the query turned up a file with a list of voters, and then alarmed when a subsequent simple data pull ended up retrieving the birth dates, driver's license numbers, and partial social security numbers of more than 6 million voters in the state, as well as county election supervisors' passwords for the voting systems and tabulators, the 100% unverifiable touchscreen systems used across the entire state of Georgia on election day. He also discovered the server had a software flaw that an attacker could exploit to take control of the machines. The unsecured server the LAM exposed back in August 2016 is part of an election system, the only one in the country that is centrally run by the state and relies entirely upon computerized touchscreen voting systems for voters on election day. That system is now at the heart of a legal and political battle with national security implications, Washington Post reports. On one side are activists who have sued the state to switch to paper ballots in the November midterm elections to guard against the potential threat of Russian hacking or other foreign interference. Only foreign interference, Ms. Nakashima? On the other side is Secretary of State Brian Kemp, who has declared the electronic system secure and contends that moving to paper ballots with less than 2 months to Election Day would spawn chaos and undermine confidence among Georgia's 6.8 million voters. When Georgia voters cast their ballots this fall, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported on Friday, some will wonder whether the state's outdated touchscreen voting systems are safe and accurate. Election officials say voters have nothing to fear, but election integrity advocates say there is good reason to worry. And as of this week, so does a federal U.S. District Court judge in Georgia who found a, quote, mounting tide of evidence that the state's digital voting system is at risk. Georgia, along with Maryland, was the first state in the nation to move to electronic voting systems back in 2002 when they were touted as a superior technology in the wake of alleged problems counting Florida's punch card ballots back during the 2000 presidential election. And now Georgia is one of the last in the country to continue to rely on those systems. Just four other states, Delaware, Louisiana, New Jersey, and South Carolina, use electronic voting machines statewide with no verifiable paper record at all. That's for all voters on Election Day, but many states still use them, at least in parts of their states, all across the country, and all states use computers to tabulate results almost entirely without checking any of those votes to assure that the computers counted them correctly. Election officials, according to the Journal Constitution, acknowledge that Georgia's voting system should be phased out and replaced with paper ballots, but they remain certain that the state's 27,000 direct recording electronic voting machines, those are the 100% unverifiable touchscreen systems I have been yelling and screaming about for so many years, that those systems will work well for one more election at least. Secretary of State Brian Kemp said on Monday, quote, I'm very confident of where we are in the Secretary of State's office and where the counties are to get ready to vote on our secure system, as he described it. And I guess he should know, and we should simply trust Kemp on all of that, because as the state's top election official, it turns out he is also running for governor. He is the Trump-endorsed Republican nominee to become the state's next governor in his race against Democrat Stacey Abrams, who could become the nation's first African-American female governor. So I see no reason why we should question Mr. Kemp on that, since he's also overseeing his own election. Why worry? Why worry about being able to verify the results? Instead, we should, as the AJC article asks, simply trust the unverifiable systems and the Secretary of State, who has a huge conflict of interest in overseeing this year's crucial midterm elections. Voters can have confidence in our system. Their votes will be counted accurately. That was Kathy Cox, a Democrat who oversaw Georgia's transition to electronic voting systems back when she was Secretary of State from 1999 to 2007. She said, I have great confidence in the security layers that we have in place for storing the equipment, for testing it, and the checks and balances at the end of every election day that have proven to work over the last 16 years. Cox, after overseeing the state's move to 100% unverifiable Diebold touchscreen systems in 2002, the very same ones that are still in use today in the Peach State. She was once featured on Diebold's sales brochure with her photograph and praises sung for those systems. That even while she was serving as Secretary of State at the time. So concerns about these systems are not necessarily, nor should they necessarily, be a partisan issue. Nonetheless, while Kemp says everything is secure and voters should simply trust him on that, his challenger for the governor's race is not quite as confident. Democrat Stacey Abrams is encouraging voters to vote by mail on hand-marked paper ballots, a message she has spread on Facebook and on Twitter. She says, quote, "I believe in trust but verify, so we have to use paper ballots that come with absentee balloting if we want to make sure all our votes are going to get counted." That was last month during a town hall meeting. This past week, as part of a lawsuit filed by a multi-partisan group of plaintiffs seeking to force the state of Georgia to convert to the paper ballots that are used for the absentee voting systems across the entire state and have been for years in all the counties in Georgia, that lawsuit had a ruling. And U.S. District Judge Amy Totenberg agreed that the system is not secure. She said election officials have not dealt with security vulnerabilities that could undermine voters' trust in elections. However, she ruled against the motion to convert the state to paper ballots immediately, citing the potential for voter confusion and staffing shortages and the chaos that defendants in this case, Brian Kemp, have claimed would occur if the switch was made before November 6th. Judge Totenberg's ruling, however, while a short-term loss for plaintiffs, was seen as a, quote, huge ruling for those challenging similar systems in other states like South Carolina. Joining us to explain the ruling and why it should be seen as an overall win, I think, for election integrity, is one of the plaintiffs who has joined us many times on this show as this case has continued and still continues to this day to move forward. Marilyn Mark, she's a longtime expert advocate for free and fair elections as executive director of the Coalition for Good Governance, one of the plaintiffs in the Georgia case, and a nonpartisan nonprofit organization committed to fair elections and government transparency. Marilyn Marks, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thank you so much, Brad. I really appreciate your having me, and I appreciate your staying on top of Georgia for so long.
Well, someone's got to, and I know you have been doing this so now for a long time. Let's get to U.S. District Judge Totenberg's ruling in this motion to dump the voting systems and move to paper ballots, an argument that she rejected. She argued in her ruling that although plaintiffs have demonstrated, quote, the threat of real harms to their constitutional interests, she nonetheless worried about the massive scrambling required, as she said, for a last-minute change to paper ballots. And she also chastised the state, saying they've been too slow to respond to serious vulnerabilities in their voting system. And then she subsequently allowed a further delay in changing from that system, even though saying further delay, quote, is not tolerable. Am I reading all of that correctly, Marilyn?
You are indeed. And I think that the defendants put the judge in a very difficult place because they essentially, Brad, threatened that they would sabotage the election. They didn't really use those words, but they said, look, we're going to shut down early voting locations in Fulton County. Fulton County has 21 early voting locations.
Mm-hmm.
They said, we'll go down to 3. In their briefing,
wow,
they actually said they would go down to 1. They also said they may close election day polling places if she were to require them to go to a paper ballot.
Now, Fulton County,
there was absolutely no reason for that, of course. Excuse me, Greg, go ahead.
Well, no, I was going to say Fulton County, of course, is Atlanta. What was the reason?
Right.
Why would they have to shut down polling places simply because they moved to the same paper ballots that they mail out to absentee voters? Why would that affect the number of polling places, according to them?
Totally ridiculous. the idea would be that somehow it would be so difficult for voters to understand how to take the cap off the pen. I mean, they didn't literally say this, of course, but right. It would be so confusing to voters to know how to mark a paper ballot that, you know, we would need all these extra workers, and that there would just be so much confusion as far as issuing a paper ballot instead of the very complex process that's involved in issuing the voter access cards and explaining to people how to work on a touchscreen machine, mm-hmm. which, of course, is far more complex than issuing a paper ballot. But that was their theory, that nobody's voted a paper ballot. They don't know what they look like. The poll workers would have great difficulty making this conversion. And then their excuse for early voting was that they would have to have so many different types of ballots available at the early voting locations that they just couldn't handle this paperwork, just couldn't handle ballot-on-demand printers, which they already have.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they would just be required to shut down these locations.
A ballot-on-demand printer, just to clarify, that's a type of printer that can print out a ballot for any precinct, essentially, any district that would be needed by any voter who comes in to vote at an early voting location.
That's right. And the county already has quite a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, unfortunately, you know, there's just not a real valid excuse. When you look at Georgia's 159 counties,
mm-hmm.
only 14 of them have more than 4 vote centers. 125 of them don't even have an early vote center other than right there in the election office where they already have the inventory of paper ballots for mailing ballots and provisional ballots. And so for 125 counties, there would have really been no significant change. There was no keeping up with additional inventory of paper. And so the vast majority of Georgia's voters are going to vote on what the judge has basically said is going to be an unconstitutional system, just because of the threats of Fulton County and some of the other large counties.
Well, that's what I want to get to, because there are some very good portions of this ruling that I think will be helpful.
Absolutely.
In this case
very
and in
powerful.
Other cases. We'll talk about that in a moment.
Yes.
But if I'm reading it correctly, it seemed that she was clearly troubled by these systems and by the lack of efforts by election officials for years now to do anything about these wholly unsecure systems. And yet, she allowed them to be used again. So there's sort of a conflict from this judge. Is that how you also read her ruling here?
Well, in fact, that's exactly what she acknowledged. She said, "I am in a catch-22."
Mm-hmm.
And because on one hand, she recognizes that it's an unconstitutional system,
mm-hmm.
that to have this unverifiable, unreliable system. On the other hand, she recognizes that she could be impairing people's constitutional rights to vote if, in fact, the defendants' predictions, declarations, came true. That, you know, they said there will be long lines, people will be confused, they won't vote, they will get frustrated, they'll leave. You know, our poll workers can't handle it. So the court then is caught right in the middle of weighing these two constitutional rights, and you know, which is she going to favor? And I can understand why the court, you know, has to listen to the very people who are going to conduct the election,
mm-hmm.
as they tell her they cannot do it.
And that's, so what evidence did they bring in? I understand that, you know, she's got to weigh both sides. You guys brought in actual evidence, and as I understand, even experts who argued, no, it doesn't take any longer to vote on paper ballots. In fact, if you have paper
Correct.
Ballots, you can have as many people as they want can vote at the same time. It's not limited by the number of voting machines. And I want to talk about some of the evidence you brought in a second. But did they bring in any evidence to support their argument that there would be chaos, longer lines, et cetera?
Not really. What they did is they brought in four or five Georgia election officials who are in charge of running the larger counties in Georgia. And they all claimed, oh, we don't have time and we wouldn't be able to find ballots and we don't have enough scanners and, you know, our people would be confused and we can't. And then, of course, we had no Georgia officials to say, oh, yes, we can. Mm. Now, we did have one declaration that was in the record, but we had numerous election officials from outside of Georgia who have done it, who have gone through it, mm-hmm. and have said, it's very doable. This is very, except, you know, we didn't have those people from Georgia. And it was the very people who have to conduct the election who were complaining that they could not do it. And that was their evidence, unfortunately, and that was persuasive.
And yet you guys brought in, you guys meaning the plaintiffs, actually brought in, for example, University of Michigan computer scientist Professor Alex Halderman to demonstrate how easily these machines can be flipped, the results can be flipped without possibility of detection. Tell me about that demonstration and how it was received in the courtroom.
It was an abbreviated demonstration, but, I think that the judge came into the courtroom already well understanding that this was possible. She had really read the all of the scientific work, mm-hmm. the experts' opinions, and so, you know, I think what she saw from Professor Halderman merely confirmed what she was already well aware of from all of the reading that she had done. And then we called Professor DeMillo to the stand, mm-hmm. who is from Georgia Tech. He is himself a Georgia voter, very familiar with the Georgia system, and he talked about the weight of the National Academy of Sciences that had just, issued the previous Thursday a report saying every effort must be taken to have 2018 elections conducted on paper. And so the court was already, very well aware of the science. And mm-hmm. she was quite aware of the lack of any effort and lack of any science and lack of any expert testimony put on by the defendant.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that her decision didn't rest on the science there at the, at the very last, because she well accepted the science.
It was
this whole threat of chaos.
There are a couple of key things that the court did decide in your favor, namely on whether your group has the federal constitutional standing to bring a challenge at all. In other words, the constitutional issues sufficient to make a federal case out of this, so to speak, and whether, as the defendants argued, state law had required them to use these 100% unverifiable touchscreen systems. Let me hit to both of those briefly. What did she determine as far as constitutional standing here? And I'm wondering how this will affect both your ongoing case and cases elsewhere. And did the defendants actually argue that the state law required them to use these unverifiable systems?
So let's talk about the important thing here first, and that is, yes, she said that we are likely to prevail on the merits mm-hmm. as we move forward in this case, and our claims are, related to constitutional claims. And that is what the scholars, the lawyers, the election advocates across the country are recognizing as such a very important finding and ruling that she has made here, is that, yes, we are likely to prevail in our argument that this is an unconstitutional system when the voters cannot rely mm-hmm. on an auditable and verifiable system. So that is what's very important when she said, yes, we're going to prevail on that argument. Did the state claim that the state law forced them to DREs. They certainly did, and she blew that apart, as we have been saying for a year. Now, one other thing, Brad, that you may not be aware of that we brought out in court, the state not only had been saying that it was required by state law, but they had threatened the counties who began to recognize it wasn't required by state law and that the counties' local authorities have the ability on their own to go to paper ballots. The Secretary of State has been threatening them, telling them, no, you do not have that authority. They even told the press that they would punish counties that went to paper ballots. Yes.
Well, see, that's very interesting because, you know, I mentioned from that report from the Washington Post where Ellen Nakashima said on one side are activists who have sued the state to switch to paper ballots to guard against the potential threat of Russian hacking or other foreign influence. Well, Russian and foreign interference is hardly the only threat to an election in Georgia. Did your lawsuit only focus on foreign manipulation? Meanwhile, you've got this Secretary of State who is threatening counties, who is making claims that can't be backed up, who is now overseeing his own election for governor in Georgia. He has, and other, you know, election officials and folks who run the machines, they have direct access to these systems to flip election results. Was that a concern of the judges in this case?
You know, I can't say that she what her concerns were specifically on that, but I think the judge understood, as we all do, that the intent to conduct election malfeasance is not limited. It could be Trump's 400-pound guy in New Jersey, and it could be somebody right in the Secretary of State's office, or who knows where. But certainly, this country has a history of fraud occurring in elections going back to the founding of our country. So there's nothing that would make us believe that conducting elections on electronics, somehow made all of the citizens of Georgia pure of heart.
I've got a couple of questions about where we go from here and moving ahead.
Okay.
But, you know, even Kemp himself has claimed that he'd like to replace these systems, but he's pushed for a system that is yet another touchscreen type system that prints out barcoded ballot summary cards instead of actual hand-marked paper ballot systems. So I guess, do you have a sense from this case and from the court testimony, what is the fear here, as far as you can tell, in Georgia about allowing hand-marked paper ballots that we can actually know represent the intent of the voters? Many people, I suspect, listening here probably think this is, you know, a nefarious intent from Brian Kemp, and I don't know if you would agree with that or not. What's the sense that you get? Why are they so opposed to what seems like a common sense change here?
You know, there is no rationale. There is no logic that would account for his opposition. I will tell you what they've tried to do quite a lot to confuse the average voter. Every time we say hand-marked paper ballot, what they turn around to say, and they've even said it to the court spread, they're talking about hand counting. To hand count the election would take weeks. They want to go back to the Stone Ages. And so that's what the voters hear.
So they're
well know that that's not what we were looking for.
Well, they're confusing hand counting paper ballots with hand marked paper ballots.
That's right. And, you know, they are making it sound like it would be a nightmare. You know, they talk about voting with pencil and, you know, having the old-fashioned kind of pencil marks being erased and that sort of thing. Obviously, we have none of that in mind. But they have purposely tried to scare average voters away from it by pretending that it is former Secretary Kathy Cox tried to say on the witness stand that, oh, nothing's more fraudulent, more opportunity for fraud than old paper ballots. You know, she's just absolutely wrong, but that's what they promoted.
And
so Brad, may I?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, may I tell you one thing from the hearing?
Sure.
That I later thought, man, I'm glad Brad wasn't in the room. He would have, his head would have exploded. One thing that happened on the witness stand is when Michael Barnes, who was, you know, right under Merle King at KSU and then is now in charge of the voting system at the secretary's office, what we learned, this part wasn't too surprising, that after Logan Lamb got into the system, they did no analysis, no forensic review, no type of review at all to see what had happened during those many, many months where any bad guy in Georgia, the nation, the world, could have gotten into the system. They didn't bother to look. Not one thing. But worse, they had not even bothered to read all of Logan Lamb's affidavits as to what he saw, the files he looked at, the files he downloaded, what he could have done. Michael Barnes, who runs the voting system, had not even bothered to read Logan Lamb's.
And Logan Lamb discovered pretty much the entire system just sitting there for anybody to download, anybody to affect, and it was months before, you know, after he reported it and before they finally removed it. In fact, that material may well have been sitting there for years, as far as we know. You're right. My head might explode. Thankfully, I've only got a minute or two here. Very quickly, Marilyn, Stacey Abrams. Oh, and let me underscore again. So Kathy Cox is a Democrat. You, I should say, Marilyn Marks, are a Republican. So this is not a right-left issue, or at least it shouldn't be. But the Democrat gubernatorial candidate here, Stacey Abrams, is encouraging people to vote by mail in Georgia. At this point, just weeks out from the election, is that the best way for voters to get their votes counted in the state of Georgia, at least?
You know, it might be. Ask me again in a couple of weeks, Brad. I'm hopeful that maybe there can be some other measures taken. But Georgia has a terrible history of rejecting mail ballots. They are the eighth worst in the nation. There is no voter protection. Any partisan can reject a ballot signature without any real test. And, you know, when Stacey Abrams is out there saying, look, use a paper ballot so that your vote can be verified, so that it is verifiable. I'm sorry, in Georgia, there are no verification processes. You know, right now, all they do with a paper ballot is they treat it just like an electronic ballot. Recounts are all done just with the memory card, same machine. They don't do any hand counts. And so while it is better than nothing, is better than the DRE, it's not much better right now. It needs vast improvement. And it's okay. It's not even okay. Better than what we've got, but I'm not sure that now is the time to cast a quick mail ballot. What we are hoping for is that some of the counties will be able to take some additional measures, put in some additional controls, and, we're hopeful we can still make some improvements for November, but right now Georgia has an unverifiable system.
It absolutely infuriates me that voters are put into this kind of a situation where you've got the unverifiable touchscreen voting on one side and the possibility that your ballots can be easily tossed out on the absentee ballot side without notice to the voters. What they are doing to voters in the state of Georgia is, or at least should be, a crime. And you're right. See, my head is exploding because this is something we have known about for so many years, and it makes me so goddamn furious. But at the same time, I am so goddamn thankful, Marilyn Marks, that you and others like you are out there fighting like hell to change this at some point. I know that you guys are figuring out what to do as plaintiffs, how to proceed now in this case. So we'll have to pick that up another day as this case and this good fight moves forward. Marilyn Marks, folks can find your work at coalitionforgoodgovernance.org.
That's right.
And on the Twitters, what's the best place to find you on the Twitters these days?
You know what? They'll find me most active at Marilyn R. Marks 1, the numeral 1. Marilyn R. Marks 1 is where I'm the most active. And, Brett, I want to thank you for your motivating us. Every time we talk, it gives us new energy for the next round. So thank you for that.
God love you. Keep up the good fight and for advancing this. Continue to advance it, and we will continue to cover it and spur you on further. Thank you, Marilyn Marks. Greatly appreciate
it. Thank you, Brad.
You bet. I got to tell you, this makes me so furious.
Yes, I can tell.
Yeah, this is not radio theatrics. This is actual fury. For all of these years, for so long, this is what we have been warning about. And I'll tell you what, if Stacey Abrams ends up losing by 10 votes on November 6th, or you know what, if Brian Kemp ends up losing by 10 votes on November 6th, I am still going to be furious, because this is not how we ought to be running a representative democracy in this country. Enough. All right. Enough of today's broadcast. I got to get out. My thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, and of course to Marilyn Marks of the Coalition for Good Governance, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of this program or any others going back years, you can download them for free at bradblog.com. You can find and follow me on the Facebooks and the Twitters, and hopefully share this show and others like it. I am simply The Brad Blog on Facebook and Twitters. You can drop me email as well. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And my thanks to those of you who have helped us continue this fight for so long for your democracy by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. You're the ones who help keep us going, not the corporations, not the political parties, but you. And we really need your help to continue. That's bradblog.com/donate. All right. That's it. I'm getting out of here before my head explodes again. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.